Today's podcast is sponsored by Zencastr. I use Zencastr to record the Tally Room podcast, and it's an invaluable tool. I record pretty much every episode of this show remotely, with my guests joining me from wherever they happen to be. Zencastr allows us to record with high-quality sound, even if the internet connection isn't the best. It records a high-quality version on the local desktop and then uploads it when the internet connection allows, meaning that the audio the listeners hear is usually better than what I can hear when I'm recording. It also allows for recording video. I use it to be able to view my guests, but you can also record video in 1080p. It's super easy to use Zencastr. I set up a link for a recording and send it to my guests, and we're getting started in minutes. Go to zencastr.com/pricing and use my code TALLYROOM, and you'll get 30% off your first month of any Zencastr paid plan. I want you to have the same easy experience as I do for all my podcasting needs. It's time to share your story. Welcome to the Tally Room podcast. I'm Ben Rowey. The world's largest democracy will start going to the polls later this month to elect its parliament, the Lok Sabha, for the next 5 years. Today we'll be discussing the Indian election and getting up to speed on what we might expect over the next 2 months. My guest today is Sophia Amasari. Sophia is a research fellow at the Centre for Governance and Public Policy at Griffith University. Hello, Sophia.
Hi, Ben, and thanks for having me on your podcast.
So Narendra Modi has been Prime Minister of India since 2014 when his BJP took power. This year's election will take place over 7 phases, with each constituency holding its election on 1 of 7 Fridays, starting in April and ending in early June. Sophia, you've studied the BJP. How would you describe where it is positioned in the Indian political system?
Yeah, the BJP can be described as a right-wing populist party or a populist radical right party of the likes of Pauline Hanson's One Nation or Brothers of Italy, or even a growing faction of the US Republicans. And at the core of this right-wing populist ideology is a mobilization based on a strong us versus them identity politics. So in the case of the BJP, the core constituency of the party, which is the Hindu people, are cast as being under threat by religious minorities, and in particular Muslims. So really anything from their security, their culture, and their welfare are said to be endangered by these minorities. But they're also under threat from a number of elites, which in the case of the BJP include, for instance, the Congress Party or even foreign NGOs or foreign English-speaking media that are perceived as interfering with India's national sovereignty. And if you think about it, this narrative is not very different from what we see in Trump's political discourse, for example, of the white, ordinary Americans being endangered from Muslim immigrants, Mexican immigrants, or even from the Democratic Party itself, international organizations or media outlets like the New York Times. And this right-wing populist ideology translates into a policy platform that promotes majoritarianism at the expense of the minority rights. And we really saw that during the government of Narendra Modi.
I think sometimes you see parallels of the BJP being a Hindu party compared to like right-wing religious parties that are Christian in the West. How much does that comparison make sense, that it's like a Hindu version of what you might see from a Christian right party in like the US or mainland Europe or something like that? Does that kind of hold up?
Yeah, I think the parallel nowadays makes sense. But in both ways, it's really about using the religion as a source of identity rather than as a source of religious practice, right? It doesn't matter when we see cases of right-wing populist parties advocating for Christianity, it doesn't actually matter if you go to church or things like that. It matters that you see that as an identity mark that distinguishes you, in most cases, from Muslims. So they are really the outgroups that is perceived as the most threatening to our civilization. And in the BJP, it's kind of the same, even though their idea of the Hindu people, they say, is based not much on religion, but on the fact that the Hindu people are the original inhabitants of the Indian land, whereas Muslims came after, just a few centuries ago, they invaded India. So in the case of the BJP and the way they use religions, there is also this attachment to the heartland, let's say.
Let's talk a bit about the party system in India, because there's a lot of parties that contest Indian elections and win seats. It's obviously a vast country with a federal structure with different states, but it seems like almost all the parties have kind of coalesced into one of two coalitions. Tell us a bit about that. Let's start with, we've talked a bit about the BJP, and they're kind of the biggest party in the NDA, the National Democratic Alliance. But then on the other side, you've got the Indian National Congress, who have often been in government in the past, and a coalition that the acronym INDIA, which spells out India. Tell us a bit about that, INC and their allied parties, like where they position themselves.
As you mentioned, there are really two main types of players in the Indian party system. So we have on the one end, the two main pan-Indian parties, which are the BJP and the Congress. And then there is this series of regional or caste-based parties that are really an expression of more localized identities. So the party system in India is characterized by two main cleavages. And the first is statism, so the extent to which the state should intervene in citizens' lives and it should drive social and economic reforms. And the second is recognition, so the extent to which the state should accommodate the needs of the marginalized groups and promote minority rights. So right now, the BJP is pretty much against both statism, so in fact, it is very pro-business, and it is both against recognition. And during the two terms of the Modi's government, we saw how it really pushed for an aggressive Hindu majoritarian politics. Whereas both the Congress party and the regional and caste-based parties are more in favor of state intervention in the economy, and they are also in favor of the safeguard of minority rights. So this is more or less how the party system is structured. And both the big parties and the minor parties have incentives to build coalitions to contest the general election. So the BJP and the Congress, because they need the vote banks of those regional and caste-based parties, and the minor parties, because we are in the first-past-the-post systems, which tends to favor the major parties. And these proposed coalitions are actually on the making, right? So they're happening right now. And the BJP has been very active in striking alliances, both in those states where it's a minor player or where the contest is tight, but also in those states where it is actually dominant, like in Uttar Pradesh, which is the most populous state of India. Because the 2024 election for the BJP is really about cementing this dominance. And on the other end, we have the INDIA, or India, led by the Congress party, which is really a block of very different parties, from the Congress to these regional parties to communist parties. But yeah, it has been able to strike alliances with some key players, like the chief minister of Delhi, which is the capital of India, or the leader of opposition in Uttar Pradesh, again, the most populous state of India. But it has also received some drawbacks, let's say. Most notably, a few weeks ago, the chief minister of Bihar, which is the third most populous state, has defected and has passed on the BJP-led coalition. So alliances are still in the making. Everything can change in the next week. It's very fluid.
Yeah, well, you mentioned the electoral system, so let's touch on that briefly. Yeah, it's single-member electorates with first-past-the-post. So, you know, political theory would suggest that would push parties into a smaller number of alliances, but it's produced this effect where there's many parties but two big alliances. So that's interesting. And there's currently 543 seats, something I actually did a different podcast where I interviewed an Indian political scientist about the debate around expanding the parliament and that there hasn't been the apportionment of seats between states. It seems to be quite a controversial issue at the moment around the fact that since the 1970s, they've been putting off distributing the number of seats between states.
Yeah, there is a talk about the limitation to happen in 2026. So we will pass from 543 seats to over 750. To give you an idea, the new building of the parliament has been inaugurated during this last Modi term, and it has 888 seats. Okay, so that's probably the maximum you can go.
Lots of room.
Yeah. And yeah, the problem is, as you said, that since the 70s, the number of seats has been frozen because at the time, the government policy was pretty much population control. But the population of India has changed dramatically since then. So right now, for instance, we have an MP from Tamil Nadu, which is in the south, which represents on average 1.8 million of Indian citizens, versus an MP from Uttar Pradesh in the north, which represents 3 million of citizens. So a big disproportion. And based on the projections that we have right now with the current population, very populous states like Uttar Pradesh and Bihar in the north would almost double their seats, whereas states in the south would add few to none. So this will really help Narendra Modi cement his concentration to power in North India and cement the BJP dominance.
Obviously, it's not just that the population has grown, but it's grown at different rates in different parts of the country, right? If it had grown evenly, it wouldn't be a problem. And that the north has grown faster than the south. And am I right to think that generally, I'm sure there's exceptions, but northern India has tended to be a better area for the BJP and Modi than the south? So you could frame it either as they would benefit from an expansion, but they've also been hurt by the continued use of these out-of-date boundaries.
That's correct, because the stronghold of the BJP is pretty much in the north center of India. So the so-called Hindi belt, which is this belt of states where Hindi is the official language, whereas the BJP is pretty much absent or a very weak actor in the south for a number of reasons. First, because in the south you have very strong subnational identities with their own language, so these homogenizing Hindu nationalist project really doesn't resonate with the public. And also the Hindu nationalist movement originally was pretty much an upper caste project, whereas the South historically has seen a lot of social activism against the caste system and in favor of the lower caste. So really that Hindu nationalist ideas don't find a fertile terrain there in the South. The problem is that the South is the most developed part of the country. So if you look at all the economic indicators from GDP per capita to foreign direct investment to poverty to women's literacy, the South is more developed than the North, which also means they have been better at family planning, population planning, which is why the increase in the population has gone at different rates from the north and from the south. But as you said, this weakens the BJP because citizens in the north has far less representation than in the south. That's why they're pushing for this delimitation.
While you could have a bit of sympathy for the BJP because of that, it's also the case that because of this voting system, they won a clear majority of the last election with a lot less than half the vote. I think this is just a vote for the BJP, not for their whole alliance last time, but last time they polled 37% of the vote, which is, you know, a long way short of a majority. It's just a little bit over one third, and won 303 out of 543 directly elected seats. So not a landslide seat count, but like a clear majority with a lot less than half the vote. So as you would expect from
a majority. You've talked about majoritarianism, but a voting system that is majoritarian, that it's rewarded them with a pretty sizable majority, even though they're getting a lot less than half the vote. Maybe that will change this time if they're more clearly in two big camps. I don't know, but yeah.
Maybe, but I mean, now the BJP is campaigning to get 50% of the votes. So exactly, because these elections is about cementing its dominance. So that one third of votes that they got is really not anymore. They're thirsty for more votes and more seats. So now they really would like to get that majority that you're talking about.
Modi's had his job for 10 years. Is there any sign of him planning to step down, retire, who might be waiting in the wings to take over?
No plans of retirement right now, also because he's extremely popular. And he has done a good job, even in this last term, because, well, we can distinguish between, let's say, the more Hindu nationalist or sociocultural platform and the more socioeconomic one. And in the first one, the Hindu nationalist one, he has done objectively a great job according to its core constituency, because he has managed to implement some of the most long-standing electoral pledges that have ever appeared in the BJP electoral manifesto. So a few months after he was elected for the second time, in August 2019, he abrogated the Article 370 of the Indian Constitution, which was the article that used to guarantee special status to, guess what, the only Muslim majority state of India, which is Kashmir. So this article used to guarantee, I don't know, a separate flag, a separate constitution, administrative autonomy to the state of Kashmir. And this obviously is very much against the ideas of Modi of one nation, one flag. So that pledge has been in the electoral manifesto of the BJP since the 80s, and he managed to achieve that. Another very emotional issue for Hindu people was the construction and the inauguration of the Ram Mandir, or the temple of Lord Rama, let's say. This refers to one of the landmark events of Indian party politics post-independence, that in 1992, a Hindu mob demolished a mosque because it was believed that it was built on the birthplace of this god, Rama. And that was a landmark event because it was the beginning, de facto, of the mainstreaming of Hindu nationalism in Indian politics. And in 2019, the Supreme Court ruled that instead of that mosque that was demolished, a Hindu temple dedicated to Lord Ram could be built. So there was the inauguration of this temple in January, very close to the election, and Modi himself inaugurated him, right? Which is very much against the principle of India being a secular republic as enshrined in the constitution. And so this kind of measures really show what is the people that the BJP care about, which is the Hindu majority. So that's for the positive side of his government. He didn't do the positive side, I mean, the things he did well, according to its constituents. On the economic side, its performance hasn't been great. Like, the record is mixed, we could say. Like, GDP and exports are growing and poverty is falling, but at the same time, unemployment is very stagnant, youth unemployment is increasing, and also rural wages are stagnant. And that's not great for a prime minister who was elected the first time in 2014 with the promise of job creation, especially for the youth. So I would say very strong record of Modi in the Hindu nationalist issues, less so in the economic and development one. Another thing to be taken into account is the digital revolution, let's say, of the welfare programs. So thanks to the government, right now the government can really transfer the welfare benefits, either, you know, job support or subsidies, directly into the bank account of citizens in order to curb corruption or favoritism. And this is something that obviously is extremely popular among voters. And there are hundreds of millions of Indian citizens that benefit from these welfare provisions. So that's also something that plays in Modi's favor. So to conclude, he has done quite well for its Hindu nationalist core constituencies, but also for a broader part of the population that just benefits from this welfare program. So no sight of retirement. As regards the possible successor, we don't know yet. I have my own theory that I may share with you, and I may be wrong. I found it very interesting that during the inauguration of the Ram Mandir, that really is such an emotionally charged issue for the Hindu majority, he was there all the time with Yogi Adinyanath, who is the chief minister of Uttar Pradesh, the most populous state of India. And Yogi Adinyanath is a very hardcore Hindu nationalist. He really comes from the more religious extreme right part of the Hindu nationalist movement. So I think there is a chance that Modi wants to have him as the successor, which will mean radicalize the party completely, like going really far right. While Yogi has been chief minister of Uttar Pradesh, violence against Muslims has increased a lot in his state. So we can expect much more on that, but on a nationwide scale. So very concerning outcome. I hope I'm wrong with my prediction, but I think there's a chance it's going to be Modi's successor.
I don't know how good polling is in India, but it seems like the polling shows that the NDA has quite a substantial lead.
Yeah, absolutely. It has a lead. It will increase on the number of seats they had in 2019. So yeah, the most likely outcome is that the BJP is going to win and also is going to get more seats than it got in 2019. The matter is really how many more seats it is going to get. And the BJP in its campaign has set a target of over 400 seats for the NDA, for the coalition, and 370 seats for the BJP. Now, that 370 is both symbolic, because it refers to that article of the constitutions that I told you was abrogated, but it is also the number which equals to the two-thirds of seats that you need to change the constitution, okay, so a large majority, that you need to change the constitution. And this is very important for two reforms that we can expect if Modi becomes prime minister for the third time. And the first is the one nation, one election. So that will be the simultaneous election of the local assemblies, the state assemblies, and the lower house of the parliament, to be held every 5 years. So basically the local and the state assemblies will synchronize with the lower house.
That's not how it works now?
No. Right now, India has a very fragmented election calendar, and they basically have all sorts of elections all year round. So the government, the BJP, says this is a waste of resources, it's a disruption of governance, and it also has a negative impact on the economy. Whereas the opponents say that the one nation, one election will favor the BJP and will disfavor the minor parties because it reduces the chances of the split ticket voting.
And speaking of election timetables, all of the voting is spread out. Each constituency has one election day. And I think it looks kind of like a big state might have elections over a couple of weeks. A small state might have them all on the same day. But overall, there's seven election days. The first one's on the 19th of April. The last one's on the 1st of June. But they don't count any votes during that time, if I'm right. And then on the 4th of June, that's when the votes get counted and we start to get results. Why do they do that?
Because it's very, very hard to hold elections in India because according to the constitutions, you need to have a polling booth within a very small number of kilometers. And obviously, India is massive, so it means that the Election Commission of India needs to, you know, get camels to go in the desert of Gujarat for maybe the only person that lives there, because that person needs to have a polling booth within 2 kilometers or something like that from the place where they live. So in terms of, you know, management, it's a very hard election to run. And you have, you know, the Himalaya, the deserts in Gujarat, the jungle. So it's a massive administration exercise.
You've already talked a little bit about the legacy of Modi, the issues that he's been addressing while in government. Are there any other maybe ones you haven't covered that are big political issues in this election that might be driving voters?
Yeah, there are a few issues in these election campaigns that the two alliances aim to address. As in pretty much any election, both the BJP and Congress declared that they are going to focus on the development of the poor, the farmers, women and youth, which are the most unprivileged sections of the population. No surprise, both sides do this. But the farmers one is a particularly contentious issue. And in fact, actually, farmers have been protesting against Modi's government since 2020. So since the moment the government passed 3 bills that will really reduce the government interventions in agriculture to leave more opportunities for the private sector to come in. But the farmers are scared that without this state protection, they will become more vulnerable to businesses. And they protested so much that Modi had actually to repeal the 3 laws. But now they're protesting again. So their main demand is the minimum support price for crops, which is something that the Congress has already said, we're going to guarantee you that, whereas the BJP is still a bit skeptical about it. But so farmers right now is surely a contentious issue. Then the BJP really emphasizes different issues depending on where it's campaigning. So in its stronghold, right now the campaign is really about the inauguration of the Ram Mandir or other more Hindu nationalist policies like the Citizenship Amendment Act, which is this law that was passed very recently, no coincidence, and that will guarantee Indian citizenship to refugees that are prosecuted because of their religion in Pakistan, Afghanistan, and Bangladesh. There are 3 Muslim-majority countries. And so if you're prosecuted for your religion there, you can come to India, ask for citizenship. If you are from any religion, like Hindi, Christian, Jain, Sikh, but not if you're a Muslim. So again, very straightforward Hindu-majoritarian policy. So yeah, the BJP in its stronghold is campaigning on this platform, whereas in the south of India, as I mentioned, this platform doesn't really work. So there, the BJP campaign's focus is more on development, infrastructure, economic growth, and so on. Whereas on the other side, the side of the Congress-led India alliance, I mean, so far they have been very busy attacking Modi rather than, you know, finding a common platform. But something that is very silent right now in their campaign is the issue of the electoral bonds. So these are anonymous donations to parties that the BJP has introduced in 2017. Now they have been deemed as unconstitutional by the Supreme Court. And so the Electoral Commission of India has published the data on who received these anonymous donations since 2017. And it turned out that the BJP got the equivalent of $1,200,000 Australian dollars, okay, which is insane. And it was primarily private corporations working in trading, mining, infrastructures that were making this donation. And the BJP was by far the biggest recipient. It got over 50% of all donations. So the India Alliance is pushing, look, the BJP is very corrupt. This is widespread corruption, which is curious because it's the platform that the BJP used in 2014 to campaign against the Congress, the fact that it was a corrupt party. Then, in addition to these electoral bonds, on the India Alliance side, we see unemployment being very salient in the campaign, and especially youth unemployment, because the record of the Modi's government has been very poor. And finally, the Congress is also campaigning for a nationwide caste census. So the last time we had a census in India was in 2011, because it occurs every 10 years. But it didn't happen in 2021 because of the COVID-19 pandemic. And the government is in no rush to conduct this census, whereas the Congress wants to do it because it would help it redress the likely underrepresentation of certain castes in key institutions. So these are more or less the main issues that the two camps are campaigning on. The candidate of the NDA is obviously Narendra Modi. We don't know yet who is the candidate for the India Alliance. Maybe there won't be any. Maybe that's a deliberate choice because no one can compete against Narendra Modi.
From my perspective, it looks like Modi's going to win a third term and pretty comfortably. That seems to be where things are headed right now. So that is interesting after 10 years in power. How would you assess the health of Indian democracy now after 10 years of Modi in power? Like, obviously, they hold elections, but how free and fair those elections are? Every democracy has biases towards incumbents, but how much the playing field is stacked in favour of the BJP and Modi's allies?
I would say that the state of democracy has worsened during these 10 years of Modi in power, not only in terms of minority rights, because Muslims have de facto become second-class citizens thanks to all these policies that objectively discriminate against them, but also in terms of basic institutions of democracy. So we know that the BJP has, interfered with the working, for example, of the Electoral Commission of India, with the judiciary. There have been rulings in favor of the BJP that were very dodgy. And these were really institutions that in the past were untouchable. Like, they were the pillar of this new India democracy that was so unique, if you think about it in the South Asian context, but it seemed to work pretty well for decades, right? So we see an interference of the executive in this institution. We also see a crackdown on anyone that really question the government or criticize the government. So we see that in the arrest of journalists or the police, intervening in peaceful protests and so on. So, yeah, we saw surely a deterioration of the basic pillars of democracy under the rule of Narendra Modi.
So that's about it for this episode of the Tally Room podcast. Thank you, Sophia, for joining me.
Thank you very much for having me.
So I'm going to be taking a bit of a break from the Tally Room podcast. It's been a very busy period. We started with Indonesia and then we covered Australia and now ending with the upcoming Indian election. But I'll be back in May and there'll be a lot more podcasts later this year. You can find this podcast on your podcast app of choice. If you like the show, please consider rating or reviewing us on iTunes. You can follow the Tally Room on Mastodon at tallyroom@mastodon.au or like us on Facebook. This podcast is made possible thanks to the generous support of our donors on Patreon. Sign up at patreon.com/tallyroom. Information about this podcast is available at tallyroom.com.au and you can email questions or feedback to thetallyroom@gmail.com. Thanks to Chris DeBro for writing the music you hear in this episode. Once again, thanks for listening.